team really wanted to keep this extremely spontaneous, and usually when I have early talks with curators, they give me some idea of what they want to ask, but this time I'm...
We do have an idea. Just having seen the film, so if we start with that, and we will unpick it a little bit, the whole story, the narrative of it. But there's one really key moment which is quite striking and quite difficult, I think, to read for anybody not familiar with the context, which is when at the during the service, somebody holds up a sheet of white paper in front of the priest. And you clearly can see that there's some interaction going on between all the people in that scene, but it's quite difficult to read what that interaction is.
So what is the white paper? Well, I will start by saying something about the video, and then I will get to the white paper. I think that, I think all of my videos start with a very private and personal story, family story usually, and then it says something wider about the community, about what it is to be a Christian Palestinian, and maybe even in a larger context, it can be what is nationality, what it is to be a minority, all of these questions which are relevant everywhere. And in this case, the story focused on the death of Jacob, of my grandfather, and by telling this story, I'm telling the story of the cemetery in Lod, which was damaged a few times during the past 10 years by other religious groups. But the video also touched another subject, which is the tension not only between the Palestinian community itself, or between the Palestinian and non-Palestinian community in Israel. It's also about the tension between the community and the religious leadership. Because, it's a well-known secret that the richest family in Israel is actually the Greek Orthodox Church. They hold a lot of lands, and they pay rent. Even the Israel Parliament, how symbolic, the Knesset, sits on their land, and they pay rent. And because the center of this church is in Greece, all the money that they get, and it's millions, it all goes to Greece. They don't put it into churches, they don't put it into community centers for the community, nothing. And almost nothing. So there is actually a legal fight between us to our religious leadership. And if you look, when we saw in this video, I mean, you only see one person the entire video. It's all hand gestures, the story. You get a story by hand gesture, but you only see one person, which is the priest. And he's more like a poster. He's a part of the stage of this old church. And because he's Greek, he doesn't really know the community. So when we have a service, he doesn't even speak Arabic. So when we have the Sunday sermon, how do you say it? Sunday? The sermon. It actually takes 3 hours because we have the preach standing and saying the ceremony, doing it in Greek. And then you have a translator and everything is being translated. It's kind of comic. And in that piece, you see that in the entire very holy atmosphere, they put this white paper with the names of the deceased of his family, and just so he will know who they are and he will know how to pronounce it. So this is actually a huge gap that we have between the community and our leadership in that sense.
But there's a huge thing of the way how it's filmed, because you can see this whole theatrical scene of the service. And then suddenly the priest disappears because you've got the sheet of white paper which somebody's holding up. And I was very struck on seeing the film again that there's constantly a play between what you can see and what you cannot see. So they start having the phone conversation first and you can't see anything, the screen is black. Mm-hmm. Then we see your grandfather alive. And just as I was beginning to think about it, you pointed out that we can see you in the reflection of the coffee pot. So actually in the film. Then the plot continues there. It's the moment where we see the photographs. And this truly painful scene of tearing them apart, where...
Especially for a curator.
Yes. I actually think it's probably one of those physical things which all of us recognize. This ghastly thing when you think you want to look at something, and if you try to look at it, you will destroy it in the process of getting there. And then the next thing is that we can see the tombstone, so we can actually see the vandalized tomb, which you cannot quite see in the photograph. And then it switches again to the death of your grandfather, which is quite a difficult thing to watch, I think, because again, the scene of... we don't see what's happening, we see the surroundings. Then there are two still images, the only moment where things come to rest, where we can actually see the event of his death. And then it turns again to the seeing of the 40 days after the celebrations of the to commemorate him, and then the priest disappears and appears and disappears. So seeing and not seeing is at play all the time. How does this relate to your work?
That's a difficult question.
Let's just start with the actual photographs, because we see the photographs in the film, and we can see actually not the photographs, we can see something you did with those photographs in the actual
film. It's an interpretation
of
the
materials. So if you just stick very simply with that object, so the photographs, they existed in your family. I mean, where did they come from? Those photographs we see in the film.
Okay. Those photographs, actually, my grandfather took them when the cemetery was vandalized. He took them as evidence for the police. But then when the police couldn't... they didn't solve the case. I don't know if they even start to investigate it. They just returned it. And my grandmother kept them in the kitchen. And that's why they got wet from the steams, like in an envelope. And she sent me to look for them while the camera is between us. The camera is always between us. And she just... I didn't know that it's going to happen. It just happened. And that's how the story starts, with these images. And they got stuck to each other. And usually, going back to what you said, like, when a proper archivist see these kind of images in such a... like, such a bad shape, he will try to separate them gently. It is possible. You can just put them in water, for example, for a few seconds, and it would be. But a part of understanding what is my archive, I'll explain about it, but what is my archive is to understand it is also to understand what is the history of each object in the archive, not only as an image, but also as an object. A part of the story of this object is that that's how she found it. It's her material. That's why the Christian Palestinian Archive is an online project. It's all JPEGs, because I don't reserve them. I don't take them. I scan them and I give them back to the community. Doesn't matter which family gave me the images. And I feel this is their right. They have the right on the image itself. And I just kind of give it, when I scan it, I kind of give it another date. I mean, we have the date when the image was printed and then the date when the image was scanned. So this is how she wants to handle the material. And this is a part, becomes a part of the story of the material. In this case, it was extremely poetic, because if you watch upstairs the images, it really, you can see the destruction within what the image described by itself. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, but then you actually, what we see upstairs are not those images.
Are not those images, no.
So there's another process of translation happening between that moment where you film the looking at it and then what you present to us.
Yes, it's true. The archive, well, what we see upstairs, it's not the photographs, it's what I call a scanogram. A scanogram, just like how it sounds, it's I'm taking the images and then I scanned them with three different scanners to create the image. I'm kind of drawing with scanners. One scanner, I have a PhD in scanners now. One scanner is for the surface of the image. One scanner is for the parts that are torn, and one scanner is for the folds. And then I combine these three layers into one image, and you get a kind of interpretation of what the object is. And the reason that I'm doing this is to show the history of the image itself of as an object, and not only what you see in the photograph, in the original one. And then I give them back.
But so in those, I mean, in the representation of those images, mm-hmm. you in a way you make it even more complicated between what a photograph is as an object and what a photograph, or what a photograph is as an image and what a photograph is as an object and the way people relate to it as a memory or as a document or...
It's also a memory and document, yes. But, so, but it's also a beginning of a story, in a way. I mean,
beginning of a story is a good cue to another image in the exhibition, which is the two photographs in the stairwell. Mm-hmm. The photographs of the wedding of your grandparents, mm-hmm. which are found images. Which you have, I guess, the key artistic gestures. You've chosen to take those two images mm-hmm. out of the context in which they existed before and put them into a different context.
Do you know the actual context that they were originally?
Actually,
those two images are the starting point of the Christian Palestinian Archive. The Christian Palestinian Archive today includes thousands of images. It's a project that I started in 2009. And it started by these two images, which I found in plastic bags under my grandparents' bed. It's not only watermelons that I found them there. And I was shocked to find that they put in a suitcase, within a suitcase there were plastic bags, and within these plastic bags they kept their history in a way. Hundreds of images. And they never put them into an album. Like, you can imagine, I mean... Usually, when you have wedding photographs, you frame them, you put them in your living room. And I remember back then asking my grandmother, why didn't you organize them? Why do you keep them like that? And she didn't really answer, and she said, you can do it. If you want, you can try and start organize them. And I tried. But I failed, like she did, because I understood that these photographs are not only evidence of celebrations, of important events in their life. It's also the story of their history, and surely the story of 1948 when Israel was established. Because these two images, even though they are certainly images of a wedding, they are also the only images that we have today from documenting life in Lod ghetto after 1948. Up to 1948, Lod was a Palestinian city. After 1948, after the occupation, only 1,000 people remained in the city. Among them were my grandparents, which were hidden in the church that we just saw in the video. And life continue under military rule in the church and around the church, in a few houses there. And it's only because of the wedding, which is a private event, only because of the wedding, a photographer was asked to come in the ghetto. It was a Jewish photographer, and to document the wedding. So today, it's not that these pictures have, for her, I guess, for my grandmother, have a kind of... she's ambivalent about them, because it also documents the minute that their life was altered. Mm-hmm. Is that the right word?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Changed, yeah.
But it's quite curious, because so they are, as you said, they are personal memory to them. They are historic evidence. They become something for you to trace your own history and how that relates to their history. Mm-hmm. There's a complicated social constellation. When you say there's a Jewish photographer, your grandparents in that photograph, they are Christian, and they have a Christian wedding. In the background, you can see a Muslim woman. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things going on there.
In that image?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You decide to pull that out and put it on the wall. Mm-hmm. So how did that moment happen? That you went from looking at this and thinking, oh, that's fine, to saying, oh, I do this.
When I started to try to put this image within a context, I mean, it was video, sound recording, I mean, all of my practice. And I don't know if it was like an exact moment when it happened. I can give you a date of an opening of a show, maybe. I think it just happened organically. In a way, the entire project of the archive is something that is breathing, because usually when we see archive, they are based on studios of photographers, like the Arab Image Foundation, for example, the Al-Khadaj project, which is like 60% of it, if I'm not mistaken. And the Christian Palestinian archive is actually an archive that is a community project, because people send me their own private images. Usually we don't know the name of the photographer, or maybe it's a family member. And it's something that breathes. It's something that have its own life, and it's an ongoing... it's developed all the time. So in that sense, I think it's important to understand the archive as something that doesn't stop in one sense, but it also have different direction than the ordinary archives, because it's not only classified as years, locations, what you usually do. It's also, I call it an Eastern logic. It have like a community logic, because it's organized by families, like a family tree. Genealogia, genealogical order, yes.
But it's good. I mean, what I'm after is when I say you take the image and you put it on the wall, there's an act of communication in there.
Yes.
Because you take this image, and obviously communication is another part which is central to your work. Lots of, like your video work, often shows you communicating with somebody, or people communicating with each other. You take this image out, you begin to communicate with an audience. You just say people give you their images, so you must be communicating. They lend them to you, absolutely right. But it must be in your own communication with people. Who do you feel you're communicating with in your work?
Who do I feel communicating with me?
Or who are you communicating with? I mean, do you have a sense of who you're making this for, or how people will read this?
You're talking about the exhibitions and not the archive as an archive, because the archive is for the community, obviously.
Okay. You say obviously. So this is what, for you, it is a part of really a community project.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first and only archive dedicated to this community.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, I'm working in kind of void that. So the archive is like the source of what I do as an artist, but it has its own life, because theoretician use it to write about history, different and curators as well. It's not mine in that sense.
Yeah.
And its canogram is actually mine, because it's my interpretation of the material. I'm not sure I'm answering your question,
I was also curious, because I thought when you describe the story and these acts of translation, that very often you it sort of feels like you're turning something around when you say Lot Ghetto. Then, of course, me being German, the first thing I hear is Lodz Ghetto.
Also Google. If you do Google Lodz Ghetto, Google asks you, is it Lodz Ghetto that you're referring to?
Yeah. So you are very aware that you're inverting
Well, it's not my fault that the name of the city is Lodz.
It's not your fault, but I think you're aware of it.
Yes, I am aware of that. In a way, the archive tells the story of the 20th century from that perspective, but also we have similar narratives repeating, not that I'm comparing histories, because really this is a kind of a cruel game when we start doing it and nobody wins, but what was the question?
I also another question, which maybe gets a slightly different route. Do you feel it's different whether you show this work in Israel or whether you or whether you show it in...
You should have said it from the start.
it's one way to get around.
You're being too European and polite. I'll answer that. There is a difference. It's the small gestures. There is a difference by the way that it's being perceived by the audience, of course. I think that when I did my first solo museum show, it was in Petah Tikva Museum, which is all the museums in Israel are state museums, are public. And it was the first time that this museum actually dedicated the entire show to what we call the Nakba, the catastrophe, the 1948 events from a Palestinian perspective. And when I worked with the curator, we were 100% sure that we're doing this show knowing that no one will come. No one will come to see that show. No one will write about it. It's so uncomfortable. Nothing will happen. And we're doing it because we believe it's a narrative that we should... So I didn't even thought about communicating with the audience. It wasn't even in my mind in that sense. And then it was the most watched show in the history of the museum. And we were... Till today, I can't understand what happened. It was also obviously watched by... we had buses of Palestinian students coming from Arab schools, which never go to this kind of museums. It also happened in Tel Aviv Museum. So... and the reaction are always mixed. It goes from... we didn't know the story, we didn't hear it from that direction ever. Or... this show is... I have kind of... curate press, you'll see. I have a lot of, let's say, I don't know if it's a bad reaction, but provocative reaction to what I do, but I never think of the work as being provocative. I think that...
I don't quite believe that.
No, I'm honest about it. I think that I know by now, not back in 2009, but I know by now that when I have these kind of narratives into national Israeli museums, that the audience might be reluctant to see this. The biggest protest in Tel Aviv Museum was that I have Arabic and I didn't translate it to Hebrew, like I'm doing here. And it wasn't about the content, which I was surprised. But I know that it's going to happen, but I think it's a part of the debate. But when I create the work, I just think about a narrative that a story that I want to tell. And it's not... being political in the sense that thinking, oh, this is right-wing, left-wing, this is supporting or not supporting. It's not about that. It's about shaking the idea of what is nationality. And I think usually when somebody writes about the work or related to the work, it's about the Christian Palestinian minority. And I think it's more about the audience because you find yourself asking yourself these kind of questions. I think, I hope so. And maybe the evidence of that is that every artist talk that I do, when I guide the show, everybody afterwards come and tell me their own personal stories. Like, my grandfather came from... I mean, so people relate to that in that aspect, I think. I hope.
Which is a very interesting thing, that one of the things which I think happens in this work and which happens in the work of a number of artists working this terrain is that by making it an artistic gesture, it seems to offer a space to talk about things which it is very difficult to talk about in any other context or any other way.
And that's why it's important to keep the gaps
Yeah.
within the video, Yeah. going back to your first question.
But then, just coming back to, so you just described what it was like when you showed it in Israel at first. How do you feel? I mean, you've shown it quite a lot abroad. How does that compare?
In every place that I go, she was in it, we just talked, sorry to point you from the audience, but she was at a talk I did in Berlin, in the Kunstwerke, and it was quite, how you would describe it, dramatic?
It was very aggressive.
Very aggressive. I mean, maybe it will happen today, if we'll open the... but... I think that it's got a different context.
The key aggression being what?
Being that I might ask you to participate in a second. I just say one thing before, that every place that I go with the works, it gets contextualized in ways that I didn't thought of. Like in Berlin, a lot of people ask me about the Turkish minority, which I know almost nothing about. But that's how they found a way to talk about the war. In Texas, it was the Mexicans. I mean, everywhere I go, it gets like a different. In New York, it was the Jewish community that really wanted to share their experience. And
tell us a little bit more about the ambitions for the archive.
I think this is my life project. I don't know if I can make this kind of statement, but it's an ongoing project. It never stopped. We actually, even here in London, me and Oma, we went and elaborate the archive by video and also scanning of albums. So I'm taking also advantage of the fact that I'm traveling to go to Christian Palestinian that are in the diaspora, and approaching these communities, and I think you never know exactly where it goes, because it has like its own life. Because I never know what are the next images that are going to be added to this collection, to this archive.
How do you explain that in relationship to context? I think it's quite curious, because you, when you describe how you started, so that you find these family images, you take them as starting point of the project. And also when you talked about the films, you talked about making something very personal, you make it public. I'm quite intrigued about your working situation. Does your family like you doing this, or do they think, oh God, here he comes again with the camera, and you know...
Well, I think they are extremely proud of me, and they like the work. And if to be honest, I never do something that will want approve of. Even an artist is supposed to be, you know, careless about these kind of things. I always show them the work, and there is. Do you remember the video of Samira? You actually see her sitting in front of the camera, and she starts crying. Then she said, "Oh, I know you. You're gonna insert this part to the video," and she's just going out of the frame because of it. So they understand, I mean, we all understand what's going on. I mean, that what I do in private with this very naive small camera that sits between us, that it's going to be in some point, will have a public platform.
But you've chosen to make a project where by making something private public, mm-hmm. you do know it will have repercussions. I mean, it has repercussions. For you and your family, there's a comeback. Or there can be a comeback.
Of?
Well, you saw the friends that you gave the example of going back to go to church for a family celebration.
Ah, yeah. We talked about it a few days ago, yeah. Mm. Actually, because of my videos, I had one installation, St. George, which I just did in Boston again. And this entire installation is about the gap between the community and the church, and in a critical way, because what you see is in the video, you see the priest speaking in Greek, and then you have the translation, and it's with sound. And I won't go into it because we don't see it. But when it was presented first in 2000, 9, it was in the evening news in Israel, they talked about it, and then I went to the church, I think we had a baptize like 2 weeks after, and the priest said to my grandfather, which was still alive, he told him, Dor should stay out of the church, the patriarch is boycotting him, and he can't film in the church anymore. And he can't even go to any ceremonies that we do. He's not welcome here anymore. And my grandfather, God bless him, was the head of the community. And he told him that in Eastern Christianity, the minister is actually in working for the community and not the opposite. That's why we don't have confessions. We don't need any kind of someone to be between us, between us and God. I mean, we have a direct connection. So he told him, "You work for me, and if you want to go, we are here from the first century. If you want to go, you can go. But he's my eldest, and he will be at the ceremony, and you can start the ceremony if you want." He didn't. But since then, there is huge tension between me and the leaders of the church. But it's not only between me and them. We actually took them to court. It's in the Supreme Court for the last, I don't know how many years, that we are trying to fight for our rights on the property. We don't want the money to go to our pockets. We just want it to go into the community. It just makes sense. And I don't want to go into it too much, but even now when Greece is in such a poor condition, so they sell more and more and more and more every month to send money to Greece.
What was the big challenge for every artist when you start
one
out?
Of them?
For every artist when you start out, said you need to define the field within which you work.
Yeah.
So both in terms of medium and in terms of theme. Yours related very closely to your personal background and the story of your family, and this notion of not defining yourself in certain ways that people may want you to define yourself. It has to do with that your family is a very mixed setup. Is that right?
You're asking personal questions now.
Is it too personal? But it is too
no, nothing is too personal, I guess. You can either hug me or spit me. I mean, that's how I feel about nationality in general, because it is going against the idea of the two. Let's say if we have two main narratives now in that region, or I mean, the Palestinian, let's say, narrative or the Israeli narrative. I don't really see them as something that go once against each other, and I think that the Christians, in that sense, are between these narratives because. It's complicated for me to explain it, but the question of identity in general, I think we define our identity also by the way that people perceived us, perceived you as an individual or as a part of a group. And then when sometimes you get this kind of feeling that the Palestinians put a pressure on the Christian Palestinians to be more pro-Palestinian, pro-Palestine, and more active in that sense, because they are obviously Palestinian Arabs. But then you have the Israelis, on the other hand, putting pressure on the Palestinians, Christian Palestinians, telling them, you know, you are Arabs, but you are European Ashkenazi Arabs. You are Westerns like us. Because it's Israel, I like to think of itself as a Western country, even though it's not a Western country. And you should identify with the Israeli cause. And if to be honest, I think that my connection, my family connection, is with the place itself. And we don't fit actually to these draws of nationality. And we try not to play these kind of games.
But the archive is not accessible online yet.
No, but it's actually, I have a lot of theaters coming to my studio wants to see the archive, they want to see the materials, and then, oh, here they are, 10 hard disks, you can go into the archive, this is where they are. But I hope that in the next year or two, it will be online. It's just that, because the archive is not supported by anyone, And it's that's a political decision. So it won't be politicized. It takes a lot. I'm doing it by myself. So it takes a lot of time to organize all the thousands of images that I have. So it will take time, but it will happen.
Yeah. I really like the humanitarian way that you that you are dealing with the materials in between your hands. But I don't want to speak politics, but I don't really agree with you in the question of narrative, because whether the Greek truth or not, like, I'm also not because I'm Palestinian saying this, but also when it comes to narrative, the Palestinians, like the Muslims and the Christians and some Jews, they are already part of the Palestinian narrative. And the question is not about dragging them or not dragging them, because there are lots of Christian examples who are involved in the Palestinian narrative, because they are part of it anyway. So it's like, I don't know if this is a question, but I think it's very important that you, like, when you are positioning yourself. And also because I'm afraid that I'm sometimes as an artist being accused that I'm a voice, I'm representing myself as a voice for Palestine, so that's why I'm trying to deal with humanitarian issues, not with political issues, because I'm not a politician and I don't want to be a politician. So it's very important about the position.
It's a voice among the Palestinian general. The idea of nationality, actually, I don't want to go into history, like, too much. It was actually brought by Christian Palestinians to the Middle East when they went to study in Europe 150 years ago. And they started, actually, all the revolutions in the Middle East. And even today, if you look at the leadership of Palestinian parties, most of them are... Sorry?
Like names, very big names.
Yes, yes. And of course, Edward Said. But I think it's understand today, because this narrative of the Christian Palestinian the fact that you have it doesn't mean that another narrative doesn't exist, and it doesn't mean that they are not a part of other narratives. And this is something that should be totally clear. And I think that something risky, if I can say it, about Palestine today is that I see. The slogan is like one nation, one land, you have one. This is like the big, I can't really relate to that, because I think that what makes people a nation is a will. Yeah. And it's a will of many voices and not one voice. And this is just another voice that is among other voices. Thank you.
Yeah.
Because it helped me clarify. You're right.
I want to just point out the Freudian slip you made in your credits.
Oh, come on, Omar.
You say that the Christian minority is a minority within the Muslim minority, and actually it's a minority within the Palestinian minority.
That's true. Thank you for pointing it out. I agree.
I have two questions. One is, when you say that you can't participate in the shows, is it because you are an Israeli artist? Is it because you're a Christian Israeli artist? What is the reasoning? What is the problem?
What we said is that I can't participate with artists from Lebanon, for example, because between Israel and Lebanon, considered to be even though there's, but it's considered to be enemies. So for them, not for me, for them, if they participate in a show with me, it can be problematic back in Lebanon.
Because you are an Israeli artist.
Because I have an Israeli passport, yes.
Okay, so they do not look at you being a Palestinian, being a Christian. All that matters is the fact that you have an Israeli passport.
It's not them as individuals, I think.
No, of course. It's
how the art, and how the also the art scene in their country will relate to them. I am now in a show in New York with Walid Raed, but there are like 10 more artists, so I can work. We can be one next to each other on the wall, but in order not to make it complicated for them, they won't officially have let's say an artist stuck together.
But for you, it would be absolutely no problem. You would not feel any repercussions.
I mean,
you would not get any problems in your community or in the Israeli community. it would be absolutely fine, and you probably have tried sometimes to make this happen.
No, I mean, I will get. I can get like negative reactions, and I can be like, I don't know. Once I was held at the airport because I had books in Arabic, but only by having them. And most of the curators that leave my studio with books in Arabic are getting stopped at the airport, which I never tell them. I just think it's a part of the experience of a studio visit. But yes, nothing. I believe that nothing can happen to me generally.
Yes.
But if you really, but after me and Omar talked about it a few days ago, that after Giuliano Mayer was murdered 2 years ago, my grandparents went into stop to do what you do. They were so scared that something. But I can't believe that something would ever happen to me.
And the second question, the desecrations of the tombs.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think did that? Because you said that it was never investigated properly, or it was never found out. But there are obviously suspicions and maybe knowledge even of who.
We know, yeah.
And who did that?
Well, I left it open because I think the story. I will answer, but I left it open also on the text on the wall. Because I think it doesn't matter if it was a Jewish extremist that did it or a Muslim extremist that went to the cemetery, because it's more about it's a metaphor to our place between these communities and being such a weak minority. But I can tell you it was Muslims. Yes.
I would disagree with you in that respect, that it doesn't matter, because I think in the context of the conflict in Israel, if you make these statements and you show these works and you leave it open, I think you will find that 90% of people who don't know about the narrative, who don't know exactly and are not informed about the position of the Christian mm-hmm. Palestinians in that narrative, would probably, when it comes to destruction of Palestinian goods or of Palestinian owned things or of Palestinian holy mm-hmm. sites, you will make the assumption that it was Jewish groups. And I think that's a little bit problematic because it misleads.
Okay.
Okay, and that's why I asked the question, because I knew that yes. this would be the answer. But I think that 90% of the people who you will be talking to or who are going to look at this material will assume that because it's Palestinian, it has been somehow attacked or been somehow destroyed by the Jewish community. And that's one thing where I think you could almost be accused of manipulation.
Well, art is...
If it's not too aggressive.
No, it's not. Well, thank you. But I will... I just... First of all, art is the manipulation. That's it. I think we should ask, why do you think that people would automatically think it's the Jewish community that did it? I don't think you're correct, because I did almost all, I mean, it never happened that they thought it's Jewish, but it's because it can be, I mean, something like that already happened by Jewish, like Tag Mechir, you know what Tag Mechir, a price tag.
Yeah.
It's already happening all the time by Jewish extremists. And the reason that I leave it open, I understand what you're saying, but the reason that I leave it open, it's because it's not one religion against the other. Even the Muslim kids that went, it was Muslim kids that went to the cemetery and did, it wasn't, I mean, it's a hate crime, but it wasn't that they have like a political, it was just, it's not innocent, obviously, doing something like that, but it's also just being narrow-minded. The narrow-minded people you have from all religions. That's the reason. And I didn't want to politicize it in that aspect, and that's why I left it open.
Okay. It's not so much about basically saying that it's one or the other.
Exactly.
But I think it's leaving it open to say it could be both.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
But
so we agree there.
Absolutely. But I think it needs commentary. It needs the conversation. It needs mm-hmm. you to be in conversation with someone to be able to discuss it, because I think an uninformed...
But you know, Candida, with all of my works, there have been, sometimes people take them to and manipulate them in ways that I have zero control of. Like, and I can't really control all the aspects of it. They have always been manipulated.
I mean, as a curator, defender of the artists, I think it's artists really who should be opening those gaps.
Yeah.
And then we can all have the conversation rather than ever expecting the artist to make the statement. Irit.
If one moves beyond identity,
I can't hear you.
I said if one moves beyond identities, if one doesn't...
If we move from
beyond
identities. Okay.
And so on. One of the things that struck me when I saw Gregoropoulos was that...
That's the exhibition in 2001 in the Petah Tikva Museum.
Was that it's not simply the sort of highlighting another story of another minority community that is unheard, unknown, and so on. But that one needs a narrative structure in order to do that, right? One needs to produce an entirely different narrative structure. And one needs to think very much about the power relations between who's viewing what, and who are you speaking to? Because one of the things that it's quite difficult to eke out of this situation is that if you do a project like that and you show it in a museum within the state of Israel, or whatever that means, then in a way you're talking to a hegemonic dominant power, and you have to convince it of its own multiplicity, right? So, which is a perfectly good ambition to have, but it does dictate a certain kind of narrative structure. You know, it dictates a certain kind of voice. And so I want to, you know, it's what, 4 years now since that exhibition, and a lot of work has been made, and the work has been shown in a lot of places in the world, and in each place it's positioned in relation to another community,
mm-hmm.
right? And it addresses another set of issues. So I'm wondering about the voice and the narrative structure and the address, mostly about the address. I think what I liked so much about Gregoropoulos was that it kind of didn't pay too much attention to the sort of hegemonic culture.
Mm.
It just kind of went its own way. And so this is, I want to open that because I think we need to get beyond the identity.
I can add to
yes, please.
Comment, because my question was slightly related about the hegemonic, basically the Israeli state. I don't think it's about communities only desecrating cemeteries. It's very clear that the state has been desecrating cemeteries and continues to do so. They're building a center for a museum of dignity on one of the oldest medieval cemeteries in West Jerusalem at the moment. So it's not simply whether it's a Muslim or Jewish person who desecrated it. There is, as Rigid says, a context in which the state itself desecrates. You know? And this is where I feel maybe what Rigid is talking about is kind of, it's missing, not for me because I know it, but maybe for someone who doesn't know it. Is that my interpretation?
No, because I think that One of the things that Dole's work, amongst several other people, I think while working at the injustices of things, offers is precisely an exit out of blame, right? The sort of, because when we're in blame, we remain in this kind of binary structure, and there's no play in that. Right? Nobody else can come into being within that structure.
Gambit Kalpenot.
So I think not. I
you
think
can't
that
say that. I just understand. I mean, there's no blame.
If what you have is endless formations of victims and perpetrators,
mm-hmm.
you remain within this dual structure, and everybody else who exists in the area can't come into being because they're, you know, a quarter victimized and a little bit to blame. And so the field keeps reorganizing itself in these absolute extremes, you know, black and white, depending on where you view it from. And I'm thinking about people's work that allows something else to happen, right? Some kind of knowing from elsewhere in a different way. But to know in a different way, you need another voice and another narrative structure and another sense of audience. All of that is part of how you know something different. So I think when I saw the exhibition and I'd seen a few things, you know, a little bit in the same vein, in the same year, and I thought, you know, finally there's an opening to kind of inhabit the whole thing a little bit differently. And maybe it's too early to answer that question. You know, maybe it takes 10 years of work to understand what one is doing. It certainly takes me that long. So, you know, maybe that's sort of part of it.
Maybe I should be smart and listen to you and wait before I answer.
Referring to a comment that you mentioned earlier, which was very interesting, but in breaking down this binary and trying to move beyond identity, it was interesting that you sounded hopeful at one point about an audience that you felt or detected at one of your shows, which was Jewish, Israeli, an audience that was taking an interest in the history of Palestine, matters around 1948 and so on. You mentioned that as one reason why you felt that audience had grown and become the basis of one of the most popular exhibitions held at this particular museum. Could you expand a little on that? Just, was that something that surprised you, or it just seems that we're talking about a region where these fluid states occur so rapidly. Your work might, you talk about your work over here, and then you're sort of beginning to scratch the surface of a more complex audience.
I'm not sure I fully understand the what is the question?
Well, if I quote you, you said Jewish Israelis.
Oh, you recorded it.
In 1948, and the history of Palestine, the people give them credit.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you to just expand more broad. Was that a surprise?
That's a question for the audience that comes. I don't know how to. What can I add about it? Because I can. But what I can tell you is that, yes, the with the, I myself, I did 80 talks in that specific show, 80, and they keep on postponing the closing date of the show. And it was, I think, 6 months at the end, which is, almost every talk that we had was different because of the group. And I give you one of the most powerful examples. Of one of the powerful meetings was I met with an organization named Amcha, which they, and I work with them since then, which they actually take care of Holocaust survivors. And they brought the Holocaust survivors, and we were in the, not putting the bomb word into the in the room, but we sat there and watched the show together, and the dialogue, they were, half of them were crying. The dialogue was amazing, and since then I'm going there every 6 months, but it's now it's less. And we're doing meetings together. I'm presenting. I'm always showing the same group. I'm showing them. Since then we are in touch. I'm showing them what is the new project, and they're talking about trauma, post trauma, and. It's the most amazing experience with an audience, which I never expected to have this kind of relationship with. I think we are too occupied by thinking who's against who, which narrative competes with another, and not really trying to find a new way. Maybe it relates to what you said, Lily. Of relating to it.
Can I ask a question to the curator? Because obviously it's very forward showing, and Irit is probably right. We need to maybe wait for 10 years until the audiences are ripe to understand it, and not to ask the questions, but just to understand it as that's what it is and we need to move forward. But as a curator, how do you deal with that? How do you show, how do you make us ripe as an audience for this kind of exhibitions, which are challenging, which ask you to make a step forward from where you maybe walk into it or from the position you're walking into? So what? How do you deal with it as a curator?
Well, I guess, I mean, the clear thing is probably the first part of the answer sounds slightly, may sound like fudging it, but it's quite important. I really think my job, my thinking, is about art, and art is a particular practice and way to think about the world and to negotiate the world. So the first thing is I look at it and think, do I actually think it's good as a work? And there are lots of works where I think the story may be very worthwhile and it's an interesting topic and so on, but as a work it's not. And I think it's very important that when we have the debate in this context, in an art context, we have the debate about it as a work of art. And it needs to uphold in that. And then it has to operate in certain ways. So if the when I said that I think every artist chooses their conceptual field, that's what everybody has to do, whether it's painting or you determine it. I see this work as Laura has chosen a particular field, which has to do with photography, imagery, memory, and comes out of a particular personal context. So it's interesting that I think I'm more interested in the way it's aesthetically digested is this mechanism of seeing and not seeing. So seeing and not seeing is there all the time. And I think that stays at play. So you have information given and hidden, revealed and covered up all the way through. And formally it mirrors what it does conceptually. There are things you know and things you don't know. There's so much information there, which in terms of culture, I don't know. So if I can tell you, if I watched it first time, I would have no priming. I would probably quite happily go along with the opening conversation. To be perfectly truthful, being slightly uncertain as to which language they're speaking. Then they have the conversation, they look at the photographs, get a sense of what they're looking at. Obviously, it's set up by giving you statistical information in advance. Then it becomes this very highly subjective narrative of the death. Then it suddenly switches to the church, and there's a bit like, you know, what's going on now? We're in a Greek Orthodox church. I've got a little bit of a sense of, you know, what's going on there, but not 100%. There's a lot to unpack.
And it's also not translated. It's the only part that is not translated.
So there's a lot to unpack in lots of different ways. And I think part of that unpacking is part of that experience. But it only works because it formally works the way it inhabits work itself by seeing and not seeing all the time. It's a very vulnerable answer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.